This is a two, but it's not. Sorry.
Oh, man.
Sorry. Hopefully the blue light didn't catch that.
We're in trouble.
12.
Oh, blue man's not on.
Now you can start.
Aha. So we'll reopen it. Today is, we're off to our usual start. It's March 12th, 2015. Opening the House Committee on Business and Labor. Our first bill this morning is Representative Post. He was just here. Oh, there he is. I'm going to open first a public hearing on House Bill 2969. Representative Post, the only person signed up to testify on this bill.
By the way, it's March 13th, Friday the 13th.
What did I say?
March 12th.
The 12th.
Ah.
Hell is Friday the 13th.
Unlucky.
Thank you, Representative.
That's correct.
Apparently, you can't. I'm sorry, I am Representative Bill Post from House District 25 and Vice Chair, I guess now, Chair Barton.
I've declared myself Chair for Life, Representative.
Behind it, 100%. And to the rest of the committee, thank you. I have very little left of the voice. Apparently, this so-called capital crud can be caught no matter what you do, unless we start wearing surgical masks. I'm going to write a bill for that we all have to wear surgical masks. Ever want to get sick like this again. I'm here to rectify what I think is an unintended consequence. After the Indoor Clean Air Act was passed back in around 2007, there was a lot of discussion and eventual legislation concerning cigar shops and cigar bars. Back in 2007, when Senate Bill 571 was being worked on in a committee, Senator Floyd Prezansky brought a concern up with cigar shops, and I want to read from that testimony. He said this, "The testimony that we heard here in Eugene, we had a work session in Eugene, occurred to me that when you talk about smoke shops where there are cigars or pipes being sold, it's not uncommon for individuals who are buying those items to want to test them or sample them. And it seems only right at this stage in our laws in the state as well as in the country, with tobacco being a legal product, that this would be an appropriate exception to the bill." So Senator Prezansky, and thank you, in writing that, thought, what's the point?
Get Representative Doherty.
So sweet.
Let's give her a
call. Thank you. Representative Doherty, you're great. So anyway,
why anybody attached?
Later in the 2011 session, there were several different bills that went around both the Senate and the House to deal with what do we do with the cigar shops. There was eventually a bill that grandfathered in exempted smoke shops at the time, and don't quote me on this, but I believe there were 8 left that were in this grandfathered in exemption, and there are now 3. 5 of them have gone out of business. In the negotiations over the exemption, the idea of food and beverage came up in one of the -9-11s, whatever it was. One of the lines from HB 2726 had this in it. It said, prohibits food or beverage on site. Then Representative Mike Schaffler was working on this, and I wrote an email to him, and I want to read from that, and you have it in your materials. You should have it there. I wrote to him, and I said, Senator Schaffler, or Representative Schaffler, the bill also prohibits the consumption of any food or beverage, including water, anywhere in the business. This would prevent employees from eating their lunch at work or even having a cup of coffee or drink of water while at work. So it's anti-labor and anti-business all at the same time and a violation of employees' personal liberties. I remember him writing me back and saying, yeah, but you know, we're trying to negotiate here. I'd never been in this building, so I didn't realize that's how things worked. The bill passed. There are various versions of it. The language stayed in, and really, I guess at that point, we thought that was the end. For me personally, in 2013, my son started working at Ava Cigars and Wine in Salem, and he called me his first day at lunchtime and said, Dad, I can't eat my lunch. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, no, I'm not allowed to eat because remember the eating and drink thing? I said, oh, my goodness, I didn't realize that. You're right. So back in 2011, I was right. My fear was correct. Not only could he not eat or drink, the employee, but, of course, the customer couldn't walk in with a cup of Starbucks or a bottle of water. They have to be turned away at the door. If in your material, and I don't want to read all this because you have it in front of you, but in your material you should have the OAR, I believe it is, OAR, alternative smoke shop certification requirements for businesses existing on December 31st, 2008, and it shows you basically what they had to do to qualify to get this exemption. And then also those that were what we call grandfathered in, again, because they were in business before 2008, they had to meet all of these requirements. And it says right there, not sell, offer, or allow on-premise consumption of food or beverage, including alcoholic beverages. So that's why I wrote HB 2969 to basically just say, we don't want drinking of alcohol there. We just want to be able to, somebody to have a bottle of water, a cup of coffee, the employees to eat their lunch, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm asking, and by the way, let me add this. You also should have something that came from the public Oregon Health Authority. This came last night. And it's there under, I don't know what it's under, but it's in your testimony information. Concerning House Bill 2969, the key phrase is on the second page. It says, as currently written, the Public Health Division does not have any concerns with HB 2969 and can easily incorporate these changes into our procedures. That blew my mind when we got that last night. That was great news. So I think what happened was there was a lot of negotiating went on, a lot of things were talked about, and I just don't think people look to the future of, oh, that would happen. And so I come to you just to say that it's not a smoking issue. It's not the smoking that I care about so much. It's the fact that we have a business in Oregon or several businesses in Oregon. I don't think there's an example of any other business in Oregon where the state of Oregon says you cannot eat or drink at work. If the business chooses to do that, that's one thing. But I don't think the state does that in any other case except these three or four cigar shops in Oregon. So that's why I come to you and tell you about this. And again, I'm really glad we got that letter from OHA last night, and I would love to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Post. This is a great example of unintended consequences of too much red tape. Thanks for catching this one. Any questions, Representative Post? Oh, we're going to let him off easy, huh?
Pity for his illness. That's the only reason.
We have no pity.
The only reason.
Don't hold back.
Mr. Chair. Well, this is a good bill. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a bone to pick with Representative Post.
I believe you.
He put on his Facebook, my wife told me, that I am the cause that he has the crud. Now, I'm in turn blaming Representative Evans because he brought it into this committee. So, therefore, I just wanted to know that we're still good at passing the buck here.
Yes, Representative Evans.
First of all, I just like saying, Mr. Chair. But second, I believe in sharing.
I'm glad we clarified the record on this.
So you're welcome, Representative.
Is that a partisan issue? I think it
has. Bipartisan crud.
Well, thank you. Much as I would enjoy working the bill behind Chair Holby's back, right when he's, because he's off test finding another bill. It is not posted for work session, so we'll hold it over, and I'm sure it'll be worked in due course. So unless there are any further questions, thank you for bringing it forward.
Oh, there is. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Post, down in F, Section 1, it says maximum seating capacity for four persons. I mean, that seems small.
Chair Barton and Representative Barreto, you know what? I actually, in my delirium, forgot to bring the bill with me. But if I remember right, it's because it's in that OAR 333-015-0068, the requirements. Okay. So So what this did was we took that from this the actual statute or the revised rules. So yes. Sure, I would love to open it up that 100 people could sit down if they wanted to, but that's not what this bill's about. So all the bill is that portion of the bill is the language from
the statute.
And we just didn't want to mess with statute. All we wanted to do was remove one line. I hope that answers the question.
Any more questions, Representative Post? Thank you for that question. We couldn't let them off too easy.
Yeah, seriously.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2969.
To wipe this down.
And any instructions, Chair Holy? Should we stand at ease for a second?
Let's do that, and I'm going to track down Brooklyn Reed, too.
So, should we 5-10 minutes for that? So, committee, we are going to stand at ease until 35 after.
It's enough time for me to go get an espresso.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor back into order. Thank you, committee, for your patience this morning. I will mention, if any of you are here for House Bill 2386, we will not be working House Bill 2386 today. So with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2960. And I see Representative Reed is here, and so we need to get him on the move. So we'll hear from him first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I appreciate you having me back. I'm here today playing the role of Representative Williamson, who is not here. She wanted to be and had, I think, an important point to make, so I'm going to try to do that, probably not as eloquently as she. But when we've been working on this bill and this concept together, and one of the things that I think appeals particularly to her is the recognition that the challenges presented by the disconnect between people who want to save and those who have access or easy access through their employer is particularly acute for women and people of color. In fact, Latinos, for example, are half as likely to have access as other racial and ethnic groups. And among private sector employees, Asian workers have the highest rate of access, followed closely by white and black workers. But Latinos are lagging dramatically. As we've mentioned before, women make up the majority of all Oregon retirees, but have significantly less access to retirement savings plans. Also wanted to make sure to highlight for you a letter that should be in OLIS from TIAA CREF, one of the leading financial service firms in the country and the largest private pension system in the country, their perspective on this concept, and it's very consistent with what we've been saying about how it allows people to take control of their own financial future and prepare for retirement. So I hope I've done at least a credible job of representing Representative Williamson's perspective and comments. Appreciate you coming, letting me come back to do that. Happy to answer any questions or try to that you might have. And again, appreciate your hearing the bill again.
Thank you. Questions of Representative Williamson through Representative Reed.
How's your head feeling?
Yeah. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one, as far as the amendments, I think it's the -3 amendment. Have you read through that, Representative?
I want to make sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, there are different amendments, and of course we have a House version of the bill and a Senate version of the bill, so I think the -3s are the ones that we proposed, and I have read those somewhere in my papers here. I even have them.
Yeah,
I think the ones you proposed, Representative Reed, are the -2s.
I think they're the -3s in the Senate that are the ones we've proposed. So I'm not, I don't have those in front of me, but I would appreciate your reminding me of the contents of the -3s on the House side.
Yeah, no, thank you. I just wanted to know if when we're discussing the bill, if those amendments are also discussed at the same time, and as far as if the sponsors of the bill are receptive to them.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, the -2s, if I'm having that right, are the ones that the proponents in the coalition that we've been working with are comfortable with and have been developing to clarify and tighten the definitions and our approach. The -3s, and I think the -1s, are ones that are not proposed by us. We're certainly open to continued discussions, but I think the key for us remains an intent to connect people who want to save with an easy way to do that. I think there are ways that we can improve upon the bill as introduced. I'm not sure that the -3s help with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Reed, something forgive me, I talked to you just yesterday, I did not mention this question to you in advance. But something I've been kind of noodling around, it seems that there are kind of two criticisms of this general approach that we're taking. On one hand, you have ERISA. On the other hand, you have the inherent limitations of the IRA. And that is to say, if this is an ERISA plan, it's arguably preempted and we cannot do it. So you obviously know that. We talked about this last time. In order to get around that, you've tailored this plan to the safe harbor provisions of an IRA plan. However, when you go with an IRA plan, you're limited to $5,500 a year, perhaps $6,000 in 2016. But is there any way around that trap? It seems like are we basically stuck at $5,500? Is that the best we can do, given ERISA? Or,
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, it's an excellent question, and I think there are. I think it's clear that there are advantages and disadvantages to both approaches. You laid them out well. The if we take the approach of trying to go with the IRA structured plan, I'm sure I'm not using the correct technical language, we stand we are on very solid legal ground to avoid ERISA. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. As you say, the downside of that approach is that there are limitations on the maximum contribution. Having said that, many of the people that we are aiming to help with this legislation would be taking a very significant step forward if they got to that limitation. At the same time, I think it is less than clear that if we didn't go with the IRA, mm-hmm. that we would trigger ERISA. That's part of why we said in the bill, if we do trigger ERISA, we can't go forward.
Right.
But we're silent on the rest of the structure, because what we want to do is allow the board to work with the other states who are similarly inclined to explore this question, to work with the U.S. Department of Labor to figure those questions out. It may be that over time there is a structure that allows us to overcome the limitations of the IRA without triggering ERISA. However, the Department of Labor is under no obligation to answer a question, and they're certainly not interested in answering hypotheticals. What if we did this? What if we did that? So I think it's responsible for us to continue to explore that question in conjunction with the other states and make sure that we're hitting the right balance of protections for the state and for employers, and trying to give people the maximum ease of access and choice.
Follow up with me.
Follow up.
Thank you. So aside from a PERS, a tier one PERS, aside from a state defined benefit plan, which is obviously not what we're trying to do.
Correct.
Aside from that, there is, correct me if I'm wrong, but there is no way to get around the IRA limit of $5,500 without violating ERISA, we think. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I don't think that's right. I think it's less clear. I think if you do the IRA,
run the risk of violating ERISA.
An increased risk,
yeah, yeah.
Representative Barton. I am not qualified to say what that is. I think the answer is less clear in that case, and that's where the uncertainty is. So if you do the IRA structure, there's very solid reasoning and solid legal ground to say ERISA does not apply in this case.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you don't do the IRA structure, it's less clear. It is not the same as saying ERISA does trigger.
Gotcha.
It is the, we're not as sure in that case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Doherty.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Reed, the bill, the way it's written, and actually it's a well-written bill, talks about what's mandated in the, when we get, like, what we get from companies are information, and when they have reports and so on and so forth. And I notice on here, like, it says that employees seeking financial advice should contact financial advisors, that we don't give advice on that kind of thing. The one thing about this that it unlike private sector, is the state going to charge the participant for this, like a fee? I didn't see it in the bill at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, the intent is that the plan would be self-sufficient and the costs of the plan would be borne by the earnings. It's very much like the 529 plan,
right.
And as the number of people in the plan grow, of course, those costs can be spread across a greater number of people, and the impact on individual members is decreased. The impact then is that earnings are increased, and this is another example where the 529 plan experience can be a good model.
so you're not going to charge fees.
Well,
that is the plan, because I know it was not in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, the fees would be charged. They'd be deducted from earnings,
right?
And again, spread across all the participants. That's right.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Reed, I know you're chairing another committee simultaneously here, and you haven't sent anyone over here to rescue you yet.
This is important to me, Mr. Chair. I enjoy the conversation.
Representative Hurd, question.
So, in regards to the IRA cap, what about a Roth IRA? Because that effectively doubles the capacity. It's just simply taxed up front, but not taxed when you take it out, which is preferable for low-income folks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, I'm dangerously close to getting beyond the extent of my knowledge. I'm not sure that the difference between a traditional and a Roth IRA plays in this case in terms of triggering ERISA. I would need to seek some external expertise on that.
Yeah, I don't expect you to know. I'm just throwing it out there.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming back and filling in for Representative Williamson.
Thank you.
I know you have important business to get to. And I wish you well in your endeavors over there.
So for the benefit of the rest of the committee, Mr. Chair, we're reversing roles, because in the other room, I was sitting there hearing one of Representative Holvey's bills. Now we're going to switch back again. Thank you.
So, with that, do we want to go to the testifier on the phone? I don't want to.
Elise would like you to call her up.
Elise Brown and Elizabeth Howe and Tom Simpson.
And she'll introduce Lisa.
Guess I was jumping the gun a little bit, maybe.
Do you guys want to go first? I think I've got all of them.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Howe, here representing the Portland Business Alliance. Portland Business Alliance represents about 1,800 small, medium, and large employers in the Portland metropolitan area. Our mission is to promote and foster an environment in the Portland region that attracts, supports, and retains private sector jobs. PBA shares the goal of increasing retirement savings. However, we have some concerns about the approach in House Bill 2960. Just as the first point, the bill puts the state in direct competition with private sector companies, which is just in principle something we're concerned about. It also creates an unlevel playing field by offering a credit or incentive to drive employers toward the state plan, and does not offer that same kind of incentive if employers wanted to go with a private sector plan. And finally, it provides for insufficient savings, as was brought up earlier. 401k plans in the private market have higher annual limits, plus allow for employer match. Rather than requiring employers to participate in a state plan, we would suggest that the state could take steps to better inform small employers about their options for private retirement plans. And perhaps provide incentives to all small employers, not just ones who would participate in a state plan, to offset the cost of setup for more robust retirement offerings in the private market. And then just one last point. If the committee does choose to move forward with this legislation, we would suggest that local governments be preempted so that employers don't have a patchwork of local ordinances to maneuver across the state. Mm. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I'm Tom Simpson, Director of Government Affairs for Standard Insurance Company in Portland. Just a reminder, we have 3,000 employees nationwide, about 2,000 of those are in Oregon. We have been in Oregon for over 100 years. We also, just to toot our own horn, in 2014 we were recognized nationally as one of the top five providers of employee benefit plans for retirement, and we got 25 best-in-class awards for that work. I have submitted my testimony. I won't read it to you, knowing that you all can do that just fine. I do want to acknowledge that the stories you hear about people not saving are real. We live here. We have friends and family that are in this position. And we talk to customers every day. We sell disability, retirement, and life insurance. So we get calls every day with people in very tough spots. So again, this is not something we approach lightly. We approach it very seriously because it's not only our core business, but it also touches each of us very close. We've tried to be involved from the start in this issue back in 2013 with 3436. Amending that to get it to a study committee where the Oregon Retirement Savings Task Force took off. We had a representative on that, our head of retirement operation. We twisted his arm to serve on that task force. The final recommendations, it was a bit of a frustrating experience. The final recommendations were kind of rushed through. It passed out of committee over our representative's objections, and he wasn't objecting it to it just on principle. He had very specific objections to the kind of plan that the state was pushing out and how that plan would be implemented across the state. So we had hoped for a better plan, something better. Again, we serve in this space. We live in this space. So under the title of good public policy, we really hope that this committee will consider something better than a subpar plan, which we believe an IRA, while adequate, perhaps for some people, there are better plans, and I think you've heard some of that today. A 401k with an employer match, an auto escalation and auto enrollment are great plans. They're very good plans. And we had hoped that perhaps the committee could look at ways to incent employers across the state to implement these kinds of plans, which are much, much better. I've heard, in fact, the Oregonian editorialized this week, that if the financial services industry was doing its job, these plans would be more available and that there were missing the mark somehow, that the employers, and especially with employees that are middle or lower income employees, aren't getting access to these plans. I've heard that before, so I reached out to Ned Turner, one of our sales reps, actually sales rep for Oregon and Washington, and said, I challenged him. I said, Ned, is this true? Are you having any success selling to employers with, I would say, middle to lower income employees? And he says, well, the funny thing is I just sold one to a retirement center, which would fit that category. It is an auto enrollment, employer matched 401k. Very, very good plan. These plans are available in Oregon today. We are selling them. I'm sure our competitors are also selling them. So before we think that this is the best plan, which is in the bill, an IRA, I would encourage you to step back and say, what is the possibility of incenting employers in this space? What can the state, what's a good role for the state to play in trying to incent employers to go for something better and use the expertise that's here in Oregon to make that happen? Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Elise Brown. I'm here for SIFMA, which is the Securities and Financial Markets Association, National Trade. And joining me on the phone is Lisa Blyer. We'll get to her in just a second. I'm glad that we have a resource in her. She is a general counsel for SIFMA and will be available to address some of the questions that have come up around ERISA. So we'll get to her in just a minute. I did want to make a couple overall remarks. SIFMA is the voice of the national security industry, bringing together shared interests of hundreds of broker-dealers, banks, and asset managers. And many of our members have an active presence in Oregon, where they are providing today the products that we're talking about. SIFMA agrees with everyone, with the treasurer, that there is a savings crisis right now. And we are very committed. Goal seems to be to turn non-savers into savers. But 2960 is not the solution. First of all, some details. Details matter. No state currently runs or sponsors a state-run retirement plan for private sector workers, period. Under House Bill 2960, Oregon is going to be required to fund, build an entirely new infrastructure, provide retirement accounts, which you've just heard, and you'll hear again from me, are currently available in the private market and federal government without any risk to Oregon or its taxpayers. One of the resources I sent to the committee was this overview on MIRA. So I suggest that in your spare time you get a chance to look at that. But that's the new program that the federal government has just launched. It's been in operation just under 3 months. The most important thing about MIRA is that it does everything that House Bill 2960 strives to do. And the key thing there is that it doesn't trigger ERISA. It doesn't do so because The U.S. Department of Treasury spent nearly 8 years, studying the issue and how we can put a plan together that wouldn't trigger ERISA. They piloted it a year ago, and now, as I said, under the last 3 months, has been in operation. It's safe, simple, and affordable, and you've got the details there on the one-pager. Based on the earlier testimony that we heard from the U.S. Department of Labor, and this was in the confines of the task force workings or dealings, that there is a high likelihood that this approach in 2960 is going to trigger ERISA. So does Oregon want to bet with taxpayer dollars before we know the answer to the ERISA question? We believe that a better approach would be to let the handful of other states who are already expending their taxpayer dollars and their general fund dollars and test the legality of this approach before we do. In the meantime, I think Oregon has the best opportunity to lead the nation in producing a public information campaign about things we have available on the market now. What can non-savers access today? And part of that would be highlighting the benefits of MIRA. Now I would like to introduce Lisa Blyer, who's been patiently waiting on the phone. Thank you, Lisa. And have you hit a couple of the highlights of ERISA challenges?
Thank you very much. Good morning, Representative Polby and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Blyer, and I'm sorry I'm unable to be there today in person. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you by phone. I especially appreciate the earlier discussion and recognition of potential ERISA implications. I am an ERISA attorney here for SIFMA in Washington, D.C. Several of the provisions in the bill, including auto enrollment, auto escalation, and the creation of default accounts, could each subject the state of Oregon and participating employers to ERISA and all the fiduciary liability and compliance costs that comes with it. But based on the conversation I heard earlier today, I know certainly the focus is on making this an IRA specific, and particularly it seems that we're targeting the auto enrollment safe harbor. There is a safe harbor that was set out by the Department of Labor as part of ERISA. They set this out in Interpretive Bulletin 99-1. And I'd just like to cover briefly some of the challenges with that particular bulletin. So the challenge for the state under this particular interpretive bulletin is that several of the items listed in part of the safe harbor are very challenging for the state to oversee, because this is how you get the safe harbor so that you can offer this plan or offer this, you know, arrangement, and yet not fall under ERISA. The bulletin includes requirements that the employer only provide general information and only answer employee questions about the mechanics. Further, the employer cannot negotiate any special terms or conditions with the provider, so even if they provide for the employer other services, they can't do any sort of arrangement there. They can receive only the reasonable compensation for having a payroll deduction program, and they have to be sure they cannot receive any profits related to that. So there are a handful of tripwires here. The ones I'm most focused on is if the employee was to ask their employer questions about the investment, questions about the provider, questions about tax implications, any other information that is not purely delineated in the safe harbor, then the safe harbor is void, no longer available as a payroll deduction safe harbor. Once it's no longer available, the employer sponsor would then be subject to ERISA's fiduciary liability provision. So I think it's a complicated area, of course, and the interpretive bulletin has been interpreted fairly narrowly when the courts have looked at it and when the Department of Labor has looked at it. So I wanted to highlight that in particular, and then I wanted to leave plenty of time for questions, if there are any, pertaining to ERISA.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. I guess we'll open it up for questions for this panel and for the participant on the phone. Representative Barton.
Thank you. Question, Ms. Blyer, can you hear me? This is Brent Barton.
Yes, I can hear you.
So And I'm going to oversimplify your testimony somewhat. But it seems to me the central legal question that we are facing with the plan as roughly drafted, and whether or not this plan will fall under the safe harbor provision, or the IRA provision of ERISA, is the voluntariness prong. Specifically, whether the auto enroll feature trips up that voluntariness prong or not. First of all, am I correct on that? Second of all, what kind of case law is there that might guide or interpret the voluntariness prong of the safe harbor provision in ERISA?
So I think that is a fair assessment of it, because when it comes to the auto enrollment, right, a negative election, it's no longer so voluntary, or when the employer has to set these up and basically the employer ends up taking part of somebody's pay to direct it over to the account, and that's been no longer, of course, it's so voluntary. I'd be happy to. There are cases out there, and so instead of my kind of reeling them up over the phone, I'd be happy to have Elise send them to you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Representative Evans.
Yes, panel, thanks for coming in, and I appreciate that you have folks that are involved in the complexities of all this. I'm not a lawyer. I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn. I don't want to be a lawyer. I'm glad that there are lawyers on all sides of the equation. I'm a simple guy. Here's the bottom line. It appears that everybody seems to agree that there is a savings problem. I'm assuming this didn't happen last night. And I'm a little bit confused why only when the Treasurer's Office decides to try to take it on, there's a flurry of activity to try to find alternatives. So my question is, if this is a baseline, what other steps are you willing to try to put forward to help us turn the corner using market dynamics to try to get us into savings? Because it doesn't, one law, one policy, especially since it's voluntary, and by the time it gets out of here, it's probably going to be watered down, isn't going to do a whole lot. But what is your agency or what are your corporations, your interests going to do to help us move this Titanic turning to try to get savings back is an important thing? That's my question.
Representative Evans, there's a number of ways I think that there are opportunities here. There was a whole bunch of questions in there, so let me try to.
And I can take some offline for time if we need to.
Sure,
you can focus on one.
I do want to focus on is the fact that this came up only because the treasurer proposed a bill last session that was proposed. We're frustrated as a company that does this for a living that it caught us blind, that no one reached out to us and said, hey, people who are professionals in this area, let's sit down and figure out a way forward for the state of Oregon. So that's one reason we are a tad frustrated with this particular approach, because it seems like it's one person with one idea instead of saying let's gather folks around who are experts in it, and that is a particular area of frustration, and to say that nothing is being done or very little is being done. We're out there every day, we're talking with employers, encouraging them to try to find ways to put these plans in place for their employees. So that's just one particular.
But is it lifting the? I mean. It's been a couple of years since this idea was first floated before I got here. Mm-hmm. You've been talking to employers. Good. Mm-hmm. Is there a significant increase in people saving now?
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, I don't have the numbers. I could probably find the numbers. They would be just our numbers. What I do know is when I checked with our sales force, he said, yes, it's a robust market, and that's particularly for the market, the example that I gave earlier. He says that is a very healthy part of the market. I think there's also another dynamic here, which is more of an economic, a larger macroeconomic force, which is, and you hear it here in the legislature all the time, right? The disappearing middle class, right? So we have a whole number of Oregonians, unfortunately, are living paycheck to paycheck. This is a real dynamic in people saving. So if we're saying, gee, why can't you save? Why do you need to save more? They say, I got a dollar and I can do a couple things with that, and it's probably going to buy kids' shoes or whatever the paycheck to paycheck dynamic is. No plan either I sell or the state puts in place will fix that. It's a real issue, don't get me wrong.
Here's a follow-up just to that, and then I'll be quiet for a while. But we put together Social Security at the heart of the Depression. People had, I would argue, less fluidity in their paychecks then. And it was successful, I think, because it wasn't voluntary. To the extent it was successful. So I just encourage whatever happens with this particular bill, strongly encourage, that we find baseline, if there is going to be a government system, but also on top of that, because whatever is put in place here will not be sufficient for the need because of the problems you've outlined. Thank you.
May I jump in here for a moment? I'd just like to highlight, you know, this is definitely, we absolutely agree there's a savings challenge. And so I've been working in this space now almost 15 years, and some years ago I started working with Mark Avery over at Treasury Department, and that was kind of where we had started talking about a retirement bond, actually, with what eventually became MyRA. But it took us a number of years because we were trying to work through all the challenges, right? The challenges when you have somebody who maybe all they have for savings is $10, $15, $20, and you're trying to convince them, okay, that's enough, let's get you started. Most accounts out there, right, it's hard to get a $20 account started. The idea with this MyRA was to start with a small account, get people thinking about saving. Once they're saving and they start seeing there's an amount of money there, then they will want to save more. And actually, the next conversation, I'm going to sit down with Mark again in just a couple weeks, because we want to talk about, all right, we started the program. We're getting people enrolled. We're getting people engaged. And then we've got to think through the next step so that once they have an amount that is worth really investing in the equities markets, then we focus on how do we turn the small, what we'll start as small accounts, how we're going to turn those into real retirement accounts. Because, you know, certainly a small account, this is for the folks that we're just trying to convince it's worth saving, it's worth putting aside a little bit of money. And so that's why it took us so long to get this program, you know, get it off the ground. We are a strong advocate for this MyRA program. And so we're hopeful that as people start with the small accounts and then eventually they become the bigger accounts and they eventually get them to retirement, we really hope this will be the sea change.
Representative Noss, question?
No, I think my question and comments were made. Thank you.
Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I mostly just have a few comments about testimony I've heard so far. Three, basically. So starting with, I guess as a preface, Representative Evans stated something that I've been thinking, which is this isn't created overnight, right? This is literally a crisis that's looming in Oregon. And so I kind of also meet with a little bit of skepticism, the idea that all of a sudden the private industry is coming forward and saying, oh, no, help us help you solve this. Well, if you guys were solving it, there wouldn't be a crisis headed our way in the first place. If the private marketplace, if the status quo was sufficient to help these folks save. So that's one kind of preface. And so, Ms. Brown, you know, you kind of offered an alternative idea to help us spread a quote public information campaign about this MyRA. What that sounds to me like is spending tax dollars to advertise for private industry, which when you talk about spending tax dollars on setting up this program, I'm not sure how much the public would like us spending tax dollars on a public information campaign, i.e. an advertising campaign for private industry. And the reality is what we're looking at now is we don't have a choice of whether or not we're going to spend public tax dollars. We're either going to spend them in significant public services for seniors in the future, because we're literally heading for a crisis where unless we spend significant public resources, they're going to be homeless seniors or seniors working into their 90s, which I don't think are options we want in Oregon. So the question of whether or we not are going to spend public tax dollars, that ship has sailed. The question is, can we spend less by setting up a system that clearly the status quo is not serving Oregonians who need to save? Additional point on in terms of, and Representative Barton kind of alluded to this, but whether the $500 or $5,500 to $6,000 a year is sufficient. We're talking about Oregonians, Mr. Simpson, as you mentioned, that are having a hard time putting aside a dollar. That's $500 a month. I think it would be amazing if Oregonians could max out what would be an IRA form of that's putting away much more money than they're putting away today. So whether or not it's sufficient, again, I think that highlights why the private market is not serving these folks well, because you don't even see that as a worthy amount where, oh my gosh, if we have people putting away $500 a month, that would be incredible. So that's kind of a second point. And then finally, we passed a task force on this, so I push back a little bit on the characterization of this the insurance industry blind, because we're not just pushing forward this bill. There was a task force put together 2 years ago, so there was lots of conversations about the task force. Then there was a task force. Not all bills start with a task force, so I think it's actually quite honorable and generous of the sponsors that they actually had this 2.5-year process leading up to this bill, or more leading up to this bill. So the idea that it caught you blind, I think, is a little bit of an exaggeration, given that there was a task force. This solution has been talked about for a long time. So those are kind of my general comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't know that anyone's been caught blind. At least I haven't heard that. I think the issue that I saw was, and I think Representative Reed mentioned this when he was asked, the dollars to set up the fund, where would they come from? And he said they would come from the earnings, but initially they would have to come from deposits. And so that seems to be the hiccup as far as starting up individual retirement accounts. What is the minimum that anyone can go down and set up an account and start the investment, and then what is the cost to that?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, and Lisa, while you're on the line, you can correct me, but that's the beauty of the MyRA account. You can start it, set it up, with a minimum of $5, and it has payroll deduction elements to it. Let me just highlight these, because I really brushed over them because I wanted to make sure we spent my time on the ERISA piece. But back to the simple part of the MIRA. Contribution as low as $5, payroll deduction, it's portable. There's been lots of discussion as to whether 2960's plan is outlined as portable. We don't see it as portable. Portable means I can start my account here in Oregon and I move to Idaho. I still have that account. It's a federal account. And I can roll the balance into the private sector at any time. You max out at either 30 years or 15,000. It's safe. It's a Roth, so there's no risk. And it's backed by the federal government, guaranteed principal, and it never goes down. And to your point, Representative Barreto, low minimum, low contribution requirement, and no cost to open. So there is more, if you want to study it a little bit more, myra.treasury.gov. But it has a pathway for employers to get resources they need to help advertise to their employees, to encourage them to open a MIRA. It has a pathway for an individual if their employer does not use payroll deduction. So I would encourage this committee to study that MIRA. We think it's a great resource.
Representative Doherty.
Yeah, actually, I have a couple of questions that deals with this. I mean, we all know why ERISA was passed, and that's because businesses did not fund their pension plans. And people who are expecting to get X amount of pensions, whether it be a defined benefit or defined contribution, ended up with 10 cents on the dollar. And so that's why ERISA was there, and it was because of the bad players who were not either putting money in retirement or they were spending somebody's retirement account. So that's why ERISA began. But following up, Alyssa, with some of your things, the MIRA is administered by whom?
By the federal government.
Okay. And so who do they use for their financial advisors?
Lisa, you might help me with that.
Yeah, so it actually would be the Bureau of Public Debt that would actually be managing it. So it's in effect the equivalent of purchasing a CD.
Okay. So it's
it would be backed by the federal government.
Okay, so it's not necessarily a if I can have a couple of follow-ups.
Follow-up.
So it's not necessarily something that you would invest like an IRA, or you're investing in stocks and bonds and munis and that kind
Correct.
Of thing. It would be a CD.
Because it's intended to be a principal preservation account,
okay.
which is actually why they've called us in to come sit down and talk through at what point we think we should be working with folks in those accounts to encourage them to roll to move that account where they can invest in more equities and invest directly to the into the market.
Can I ask you what the return usually is on this? Do you know?
Actually,
I'm sorry.
You know what? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what Treasury has set it at.
Okay. But Treasury sets what the return is?
Correct.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Okay.
Through the Bureau of Public Debt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. A couple of questions for the panel, and this deals with, I mean, we've talked about, and I've talked to some of you about whether private sector companies and private financial advisors will take on clients who will give you $20. And so my question is for some of the privates, what sort of minimum account amount do you have to do to open up a retirement account? Is there a industry standard or?
Chair Hulvey, Representative Doherty, we sell employee through employers.
Right.
So I can't address the individual market. I don't know if you have that information, Elise.
And Lisa, feel free to jump in, but I believe we have products that are very similar to what Myra is offering. So
and I know
directly targeted to, again, the non-saver. So, and that seems to be really what the goal is. Our target audience, it's not those that can access plans today, but it's those that aren't saving, and we need to get them to start saving, and this is a way to do that.
And another follow-up, and maybe this might be more for Elizabeth, and I'll pose the questions if you can get back to me with the information. And I think one of them is, what is the minimum amount? That and these were a lot of the companies that the Portland Alliance might represent, and that would be smaller financial advisors. And so what would be a minimum account? And then the second question is, what sort of basis points do they charge for the administration of this account? Because I think that's something that's very important, because basis points can go anywhere from 0.75 to, you know, 1-2. So, and then the last question, because one of them was answered with Mr. Barreto, is, and I don't even know if you have the information, but how many of employers in the past, like 10 years or whatever, have totally eliminated their retirement plans, whether it's been defined benefit doesn't exist anymore, but like it's been a defined contribution, because I know that just friends of mine, they're in private sector, have lost most of their retirement, and a lot of these were even big companies. So if I could get that information, if you don't have it with you, I'd appreciate it, because I think it's very significant point, because I mean the reality is if you're in private sector and you don't make a profit, then you're doing something wrong. I mean that's the bottom line, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think it's something that if you're a very beginning investor, and everybody on this panel knows I'm an avid investor and retirement savings person and cheap. cheap.
Didn't know the cheap part.
Frugal. That I think these are points that really need to be made for the new investor and the new retired person, which they should be about 12 when they start, by the way. So.
Thank you. I really would like to move on. We have a lot of other people left to testify yet, and final comment.
Yeah. Chair Hulvey, appreciate it. I want to address the caught blind comment that I made. I apologize if I wasn't clear about this. In 2013, we were involved in the drafting of that bill, but we were called in once the bill was dropped. We weren't ever called in. It was dropped, and then we caught wind of it. What we're asking for is, if you're going to go to the retirement or any particular business area, professional area in the state of Oregon, it seems that it would be wise to talk to the professionals who are in the business already to say, how can we make this better?
Mm-hmm.
Can you partner with us to figure out this problem together? Mm-hmm. We were on the task force. We were frustrated with the outcome of the task force, but we were there. We were there at every meeting, making sure that we put in lots of testimony, look at the record. We were there the whole time. So again, the caught blind part of it is just a request that if you're going into a particularly complex area, reach out to fellow Oregonians who are living this space every day.
Thank you, and I hope that we're doing that right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, trying to see who we have.
This is the only panel that canceled all the rest of four.
Okay, let's go ahead and have Alexandra Jones Patton.
Salome.
Salome.
Shimuku.
Shimuku, thanks for this help here. And Richard Schwartz. And are we disconnecting with Lisa, or is she staying on the line, or?
Would you ask if she'd like to stay?
Miss
Blyer.
Miss Blyer, are you still there? Oh, she's gone. So I suppose we can hang up if you want.
Well, the NSA is still listening, so we really hang up.
So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please. Sorry, I'm trying to catch up with my somewhat difficult sign-up sheet.
My name is Alexandria Jones Patton. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought everyone was speaking.
So go ahead and go.
My apologies. Good morning, Chair Holvey and committee members. My name is Alexandria Jones Patton. I work for the Urban League of Portland in senior services. I assist African-American seniors who live in Multnomah County who are looking for services to meet basically their everyday living needs. This would extend from rent and utility payment assistance to food, clothing, health insurance, and any other need a senior has. It is my job to prevent these seniors from falling through the cracks and losing their ability to live independently. When I conduct a home visit with a new client, I ask their income, as this can affect the services that they may qualify for with the county or the state. What I most often find is that the senior is bringing in $1,000 or less per month into their home. That's $1,000 to pay for their rent, their electricity, their food, their gas, their bus fare, and any other unexpected expenses. So many of these same seniors did not have the opportunity to save for retirement and are now living their elderly years in poverty. Nearly 20% of Black seniors age 65 and older and 19% of Latino seniors have incomes below the federal poverty line. Some of these seniors are fortunate enough to have children that can assist them financially. However, these same children become trapped in the responsibility of taking care of their parents while continuing to raise their own children. I recently met with a senior who is living on a fixed income, and she had a medical scare. She had a surgery, and she also had follow-up visits, and now she's faced with the medical bill for what her insurance did not cover. She's trying to figure out how to pay it, and she told me that she's hoping for a miracle because she doesn't want to ask her children to help her out. I am on the other end of the life cycle, the life and the employment cycle. I'm 26 years old, I work part-time, and I go to school part-time. Although I've very recently began saving for retirement, many of my peers have not received the message that it's never too early to start saving. As my generation embarks on our careers, we anticipate having multiple jobs and employers, and unfortunately times when we will be out of the workforce because of either unemployment or other family reasons. Some of us will have the opportunity to save money through our employers, but many of us will not. The Urban League is hopeful that you will support HB 2960. It may be too late for the clients that I currently serve and that my coworkers currently serve, but it may help those of us who want to avoid the same fate as our previous generations. This would allow the state to develop a plan that would improve them, This would allow the state to develop a plan that would improve the retirement security of everyone in our state. Please consider this bill as an investment in your future leaders. Thank you.
OK,
Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Salome Chimuku. I'm the Public Policy and Advocacy Director for the Center for Intercultural Organizing. We work with leadership development and advocacy for immigrant and refugee families throughout the state. And I'm here to represent my organization and myself to urge your support for House Bill 2960 to help hardworking Oregonians have access to retirement. It will have a huge impact on families and people who believe retirement is a dream and not a reality. With all of the other financial pressures facing working Oregonians, we need to make it easier to save. The Center for Intercultural Organizing works with many immigrant refugee families who work low-wage jobs and have multiple generational homes. A lot of these families are mixed generation due to culture and necessity. These families oftentimes rely on their children as their retirement plan. These children are folks who are usually first generation, who have more opportunity than their parents receive to further their lives, but because of the fact that they have those opportunities, they are left with caring for their parents and funding for their parents' retirement, which means they actually don't see that benefit. I'll admit I am very passionate about this issue. My mother is actually an example of someone that would have saved had she had the option to save. My mother was a home care provider when she was able enough to work. She is now disabled. She did this work for about 15 years among other various jobs, but that was her passion. And my father is a self-employed janitor, owning his own small business. For them, retirement isn't an option. My mother faced disability while she was still of working age due to the fact that she could not work anymore due to failed kidneys. It fell on my father to maintain the household income. With having multiple children, I guess you can say my parents diversified their investments by having multiple children and could rely on multiple sources of income. As the youngest in my family, I do realize that retirement is something that you can never start too early, but currently right now for me that is not an option. My parents would have been here to testify if they could have. My father cannot miss work. Every hour that he spends working is another hour he can afford medication for my mother, keep the lights on, and pay the phone bill. And every hour I spend working, luckily enough I work here in the building, is spent to also help fund my mother's medical bills that she has accrued over the years since I was a young child, and pay for the assistance that they need. It is my parents' intention to move back to our home country very shortly here. And one of the things I remember asking my parents when they alerted me and my siblings of this was why? Why would you move back? Other than, of course, family reasons, and that is where they had spent most of their lives. One thing rang clear to me that made me want to work on this issue, and that was my mom saying, "We don't want to work here till we're dead so that we can live." And I would admit that it was a very hard thing to hear, but a very real thing. And so, in closing, I ask you to support House Bill 2960. It's not right that so many Oregonians have to literally work until they die. And we need to solve this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Richard Schwartz, and I'm here today to urge your support and recommendation of House Bill 2960 for its enactment by the Oregon Legislature. By way of background, I served as vice chair of the Task Force on Retirement Savings, and I submitted some written testimony when this hearing commenced a week ago. But I wanted to take the opportunity to make a few comments and answer some of the questions that have come up and respond to some of the assertions that have been made. First of all, in my own life, I am retired from a position of executive director of AFT Oregon, a position I held for 24 years. But in my whole work life, I've had 8 different jobs. All have touched the various aspects of retirement savings and retirement savings eligibility in the workplace. Some of the jobs had no retirement program. Some had retirement programs for which I was ineligible because of my particular status with that employer. And others had some retirement retirement program, which were mostly defined, which were defined contribution. And as a result of that, I have multiple savings plans that I have to manage now in retirement. Another aspect that goes to the importance of portability in this program. I also had in my work life the opportunity to, as a executive director or manager of employees, take care of all of the employment relations matters, including retirement for employees. We offered a simplified employee pension plan, which has been referenced in some of these presentations by the industry and certainly in the material the task force had. The only catch in that is that the simplified employee pension plan requires, while the paperwork is relatively easy, requires 100% employer contributions and no contribution from the employees. I also had the opportunity to establish an individual pre-tax 401k plan for employees to use to voluntarily enter. And in that one, there is no employer obligation except for an annual fee, a fee to start it up, an annual fee for each of the participants that the employer is obligated to, and about a 2-inch binder of paperwork to go through, including setting up a trust for that to happen. I describe those things because they go to the heart, I believe, to the aspects that were recommended in the task force's report, and that is the complaints or apprehensions that all of the employers who visited with the task force had about why they did not have pension plans or did not offer them. There are two basic characteristic reasons. One is that they didn't have the resources to make contributions on behalf of employees, or the resources and expertise to go through, evaluate, and make the necessary decisions about which plan to select for their employees. And they lacked the time and resources among their own employees to engage in that activity, in many cases relying on a single individual for administration of all of the payroll, compensation, benefit, and other activities that go to normal employment operations. The notion that, and all of those things, and if I would urge members of the committee, if they have read it, thank you for the report and recommendations, thank you for doing that. And if you have not or have not finished it yet, I really would urge you to go through that, because all of the things you're hearing from those with concerns about the report or the recommendations and this bill in particular were covered, evaluated, and led to the recommendations that the task force made. We heard from 9 different presentations involving some 13 different speakers and 21 additional speakers and commenters, some more than once, representing 16 different organizations, institutes, and agencies, and all of the information they provided, including, which I read, a book from one of the largest Alliance Global Investors that reported and examines the whole area of behavioral economics and why people are savers and why they're not savers, and those things that inhibit both employers from establishing plans and individuals from saving. So I want to continue to address some of the things that you've heard. One is the report includes over 50 different resources listed in the body of the report and the appendices, including my IRA that was discussed earlier. My IRA, by the way, limits the investment of the funds in government bonds, and I think those are earning somewhere in the neighborhood, depending on the weekly auction, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2%, 2 to 3% right now. The notion, we also reviewed, which was provided by the industry representative on the task force, a 10 by 12 grid or 120 different cells that compared 10 different plan types on 12 different characteristics. So we had plenty of information. And again, all that pointed to was the underlying issue about time and resources and money on the part of small employers to set up pension and savings plans for their employees. I should mention also that much of what you hear causes a tendency to think about this as affecting only the private for-profit sector in employment settings. But Oregon has a large segment of nonprofit or tax-exempt employers as well. In the most recent Oregon nonprofit sector report from Portland State University, there's something like 10,000 not-for-profit employers in the state of Oregon. There's also the notion of the size of the employer, which factors into these decisions that are made or not made. Something like 87% of the businesses in Oregon employ less than 20 employees, and about 60% employ less than 5 employees. These are all numbers and well-sourced with over 80 footnotes in the report and recommendations from the board. So these aren't things that we had any particular tendency to suggest or recommend just on our own, but we studied this thoroughly over hundreds of hours of individual time to get at the root causes. The notion, the reason I raised the issue and ask you to keep in mind when you're evaluating this, the notion of or the number of tax-exempt or nonprofit employers is because of the suggestion that's been made several times about incenting or providing incentives to employers for setting it up. Tax credits don't do anything for a tax-exempt organization. So if you discuss tax credits as a way of dealing with this, you're leaving out a large segment of the employers in the state of Oregon. Another thing I'd like to urge you to take care in is that as I read the bill, there is no plan per se yet. That the actual plan is left to the board that House Bill 2960 creates. The bill outlines the contours or the general skeleton, but the actual plan to meet those requirements will have to be developed by the board, taking all of those requirements or considerations into account, as well as the issue of ERISA. We heard from several Department of Labor representatives in the course of the task force, and one thing was crystal clear. Despite what you've heard and the representations that have been made today, those representatives said, we don't answer speculative questions. We're not going to issue opinions or comments on what ifs. The reason for that was pretty understandable that once they do that, others and issue those, others rely on those, even though they're not tested against real facts. And so we understood that, and we also understood what potential problems were with ERISA, and that's why the recommendations, which the bill attempts to codify, is if you run afoul of ERISA, all bets are off. And so the board that's created will have to be very mindful in its design and the features in implementing those characteristics to do what it can to avoid entanglements with ERISA to preserve the underlying objective. And that is to improve, which were the two elements of the task force's charge, was to increase the number of savers and improve the amount those who are saving can save. And with that, I appreciate your time and patience with my comments, and I'm available for any questions that you might have.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I think it was important for us to listen to you, though we do have several people left to testify. Has anyone got a quick question of this panel? I really do appreciate your testimony this morning. Thank you. Up next, Rob Sisk and Luis Curran.
He's got the gavel again.
Just remember, go ahead in any order, just remember to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Vice Chair Barton and committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm going to be very brief today. I am very fortunate that I am a retiree who has a pension, Social Security, and retirement savings. I retired from Portland Public Schools as a secretary after 22 years of service in 2013. As well as paying into PERS and Social Security, I also elected to take a small amount of my earnings and put it into a 403B. I do not know whether or not I would have had the funds left or the discipline enough to put money aside to a retirement savings if I had not had my funds taken out of my earnings before receiving my paycheck. Because of this, I am able to take care of my own expenses without public assistance, without financial help from my son. I am a contributing member of my community. I purchase food, clothing, vehicle and home maintenance, fuel, entertainment by supporting local businesses and the people they employ.
Ma'am?
I pay.
So, I'm sorry, you were on a roll. I'm really sorry. You need to identify, identify yourself for the
sorry.
Record, please.
I'm
I didn't mean to trip you up. You were right in the open field.
Okay.
She was on a roll, ma'am.
Okay. I'm Louise Curran. I live in Lowell, Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm 69 years old, and I've been retired for 2 years. See. I pay utilities, I pay property taxes, insurance of all kinds, and that further supports my community. All of those services keep Oregonians employed. Even though most individuals will not have the ability to participate in a pension plan or employer-sponsored retirement account, the proposed Oregon Retirement Savings Program would enable them to contribute into a voluntary system by having a set amount deducted from their earnings that can be taken with them as they change employers. As a result, more retired Oregonians like myself will be able to continue to contribute to society and to our economy and not be a drain on it. Thank you.
I'm Rob Siss, president of SEIU 503 OPEU, and SEIU 503 represents over 55,000 workers throughout Oregon across a variety of sectors, including state government, higher education, local governments, nonprofits, nursing homes, as well as home care, child care, and adult foster care providers. About half the workers SEIU 503 represents have no retirement savings through their employers. Because of this, we see members having to work into old age with no end in sight, to work in sight, unable to enjoy the fruits of long careers of service. This often means continuing to work with infirmities, deteriorating physical stamina, and even disabilities that can be the result of years of constantly physically and mentally demanding service. But without a secure retirement plan, these workers have no choice unless, like others, they have no choice but to continue working, unless, like others that simply are not physically able to work anymore, they also retire into poverty. We desperately need alternatives to work till you die or retirement into poverty with the undignified fate of relying on public assistance for daily survival. That is why SEIU 503 enthusiastically supports HB 2960, giving workers the chance and encouragement and confidence to save their own money for a secure retirement, something that all working people deserve so they can enjoy the fruits and rewards of years of dedicated and valuable service. I have heard the word scary in relation to this innovative and urgent effort to intercept and resolve what has been termed a national economic crisis and an immediate looming catastrophe. Actually, what is very, very, very scary is to do nothing as a tsunami of workers head towards retiring into poverty, putting demands on social services we cannot come close to meeting, and creating an enormous tax burden for fellow Oregonians who ironically will be struggling to save for their own retirement. I will also say, as a low-wage worker, for many years I had the opportunity to put my own money into a retirement plan through my employer. And I think the magic, various quotes regarding the magic of compounding interest rates have been attributed to Albert Einstein. I can attest that that was such an encouragement to me to see that compounding interest in savings. And I would say for Albert Einstein, this is a no-brainer. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony this morning. No questions. So we'll move on to Jan Meekums, Roger Beyer, and Betsy Earls.
I bet this panel's working.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing many clients, but I'm focused mainly today on the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. NAFA, as it is known, represents the financial advisor sector of the economy, and they statewide have members in virtually every district, legislative district in the state. They are all over. They're in large towns, big cities, and small towns all across the state. I'd like to offer their support for the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2960. We helped to draft these amendments, and while they may not be perfect, we stand ready to, if people would like to make suggestions on how to improve the Dash 1 amendments, we'd be happy to have that conversation, work with anyone who would like to. The basic difference, and I've heard some comments this morning I'd like to briefly address. I know short time is short, Mr. Chair. So NAFA had a member on the task force. They came to the task force almost a year ago with the idea of education. The problem with this issue, this tsunami that we're facing, I've heard it called, and for the record, my members agree there is a problem with savings. It's not just retirement savings, though. I would like to point that out. It's a problem of savings of all sorts. And if you force individuals of low income specifically into just retirement savings, how are they going to plan for the next car, the next emergency, or the next medical expense? They will probably do that by withdrawing that retirement savings prematurely and paying a severe penalty by doing so, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So we would like to focus this issue not just on retirement. This is a savings issue, and it can only be solved through education, in our opinion. There are thousands of products available today to all sectors of society. You've heard that people have not had an opportunity or don't have an option or don't have a plan to save in. That is strictly not the truth. Every member of society in Oregon has the opportunity, has a plan. The options are there today. They simply choose not to use them. Even the task force's own testimony showed that when people are offered a retirement savings plan at work with an employer match, 30% choose not to use it. That's free money they don't have to pay taxes on, and 30% of our population choose not to use that vehicle. It is not a lack of opportunity, it's a lack of education, and probably, quite honestly, a lack of the fact that, issue of the fact that Oregon's economy does not support higher wage jobs. We lag behind our neighbors to the north, south, and east in our payroll. We have to fix that structural problem if we're going to solve this problem, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So finally, I'd like to close about the issue of education. Our members brought the idea to the task force almost a year ago that we solve this problem through education. We start not with 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. We have to start in grade school. And our members offered a plan where they, as financial advisors and experts in the field, are willing to volunteer their time to go into the state schools and help teach these classes about the beauty and the magic of compound interest and what it can do for us, but not just retirement, all savings. So, Mr. Chair, I know I don't want to take all the time the committee has. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any. I encourage you to work with us on the Dash 1 amendments or something similar to that. We would like to work with you to solve this problem. But if you choose the other route, it will mean more delay, and delay is the enemy of savings, especially retirement savings. We can start tomorrow if we work together. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We intimately understand the problem at hand. It's not a problem just for employees. It is also a problem for small employers who do not have the funds to adequately save, or they choose to invest in their businesses, invest in capital improvements, invest in hiring, investing in increasing wages rather than save for their own personal retirement. And we are poised to help with this situation. And the help that we are willing to give is the education piece and more conceptually aligned with the Dash 1 amendment. But to go back to a little history on this bill, to quote Treasurer Wheeler on the 6th,
We are a small, small business state. Most large employers offer retirement plans. Those we intend to reach are small employers with this bill. We agree House Bill 2960 is truly a bill targeted at the smallest of small businesses. Those are our members. Out of our 7,000 members across the state and about 350,000 nationwide, most of our members have less than 10 employees. So we certainly fall in that 87% of less than 20 employees. Being the oldest and largest association representing small business, we believe NFIB and our small businesses are a significant stakeholder in the proposed plan represented by House Bill 2960. With that in mind, we also believe we were not appropriately included in the process. Following, when the bill first started, we became involved and engaged. We attended every hearing. We testified whenever we had the opportunity. We had several meetings with the treasurer, but we were never invited as invited testimony on the impact of small business, this being a small business bill, or we were not able to participate in the drafting of the bill. The bills were introduced to us without our input. When we did have input, we did not feel like it was adequately represented. The perspective of our public testimony and that of our members was not represented in the final report or in House Bill 2960. We feel it resulted in suppression and exclusion of our small business position and our small business information. I have heard repeatedly by proponents that this is a voluntary bill. It is not voluntary for employers. It's only voluntary for employees. I have also heard repeatedly that this is similar to the College Savings 529 plan. Let me point out that it is not. The 529 plan does not contain any mandatory participation on the part of the employer to sign up their employees. We would not object to a plan that is similar to the 529 plan oriented towards employee savings. Small employers do not have an HR or payroll department. House Bill 2960 creates administrative burden, cost, and liability exposure with auto enrollment, opt-out compliance, process on termination of employment, process for transfers of plan with both termination or acceptance of a new employee transferred into the plan, reporting compliance, reporting to the state, reporting to the employee, auto escalation, as has been discussed, complications such as how temporary, seasonal, and agricultural workers would be dealt with. No study of this burden was asked for or included in the task force process. We believe this should have been an integral part of the task force duties. A real-world example, we have a member with 37 employees who offers a 50-50 matching plan up to 10% of gross income. Only 8 employees agreed to participate, and the reason they gave, they live paycheck to paycheck, and they just could not afford to participate. What would help this more than anything at this point in time is a robust economy, an economy where we're experiencing gas prices going up, wages are not growing to the extent that they are by our neighbors, and our cost of living is high. This is the crux of the problem. And also has been discussed, the two-ton gorilla in the room is ERISA. This was simply and blatantly not addressed. It has been discussed as something that should be addressed, but it has not been adequately addressed, and we heard testimony in both with the task force and since, and legal opinion letters, that there is reason to believe merely auto-enrolling an employee on the part of employer could be enough to trigger ERISA. If a business owner proceeded with a plan investing time, resources, and money without answering the most fundamental barrier to the entire project first, we would call him irresponsible at best, and that is what HB 2960 is proposing. This is not sound representation to the people of Oregon who've entrusted this legislative body to proceed with a thoughtful, analytical, and factual manner when dealing with their resources. This is a most critical question that needs a definitive answer before any further forward action is taken. No definition of state qualified plan has been provided. This is a concern about the fate of existing plans and that current plans would be cannibalized. Many organizations and plan exists to serve the small business employer and their employees. Most small employers that can afford to offer plans do offer plans. In fact, we have many members who work in the financial planning industry and offer a menu of products. This bill would be in direct competition of the private sector that specializes in retirement plans. PERS has demonstrated some problems in the state-directed plans. We believe this does not make sense for the state to proceed to do the same for the private sector. And finally, the federal government has initiated MIRA, as you heard earlier today, a federally insured savings plan targeted at the exact public of HB 2960 without the expense to Oregon taxpayers or the burden, liability, and expense to Oregon small businesses. It provides an excellent alternative, we believe, to the savings problem. We feel HB 2960 is a flawed bill that was spawned from an process that does not represent fairness to the significant stakeholder, that being small businesses. The prudent and correct action to take is to send this back to the task force, include all stakeholders with the inclusion and representation, and do not proceed to build this machine or spend hard-earned taxpayers' money until the ERISA question has been answered with certainty. We urge you not to move House Bill 2960 forward. Thank you.
Ms. Earls?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated.
Can I ask you not to repeat too much of what's already been said if you've got other testimony? But thank you.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I lost my place. I think that you're Betsy Earls. I'm pretty sure we all know what's coming next.
Wait for it.
Yep. Appearing in opposition to House Bill 2960. Oh. And the very next thing I was going to say is that I think that you have heard a lot of testimony today. I frankly don't have anything original to add. So I'll just leave it at that for today. We do support the Dash 1 amendments and would look forward to working with you on those. And that is absolutely it.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your brevity, and
absolutely.
I know there's been a lot said. I do have one quick question about the Dash 1 in Section 7 of the bill. Where is Section 7 meant to deal with the nonprofit world who are not eligible for tax credits?
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair. The nonprofit situation, which was brought up today, which was a great point, and I don't think that I anticipated or that we anticipated that issue when we were drafting the Dash 1s. That's why I stated that there may be need to be improvements to it, because Mr. Schwartz did bring up a good point on how you address the nonprofit issue. Section 7 may help in that. But it might not be the best way, so I think we need to work with the nonprofits to see if that's the best method or if they have a better idea.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I will comment that I appreciate your bringing the Dash 1 forward. I am troubled, though, with the whole tax credit scenario, because that tends to take general fund money away from education and, having the opportunity for a well-educated workforce is important to raising the standard of living, which is one of the things we're trying to address. And it sounds like you're all in favor of increasing wages, too, so we'll save that for another day. And I really appreciate your opinions and your testimony today, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I just briefly? No, never mind.
Never a dull moment here.
Don't go.
Up next, committee, we're running a little bit over time, but we have just two left, or maybe three. John Bartholomew and Iris Hodge.
Thank
Thank you, Chair Holvey. For the record, members of the committee, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. And really, I just wanted to draw your attention to some testimony that we submitted for the record from our national senior legislative representative in Washington, D.C. She was able to be here on Monday to give testimony before the Senate Committee on the Companion Bill, Senate Bill 615. And I urge you all to read that because it addresses many of the issues that we've heard here today. One of the key things that is key for our members in Oregon is that, you know, you hear that access isn't an issue. Everybody can just go out and buy an IRA. Or a 401k or something like that. But only 5% of people who don't have access to this at their workplace go out and buy one. I know for a fact when I was, as a Generation Xer, I've bounced around from job to job historically. And it wasn't until I was about 29 that I had access to a 401k at work. And that was actually after I had a higher-paying job that didn't have one. I did not go out and get one. But when I took a lower-paying job that had access to a 401k, I took advantage of that. This plan does create access because the system that we have now really isn't working. The MyRA proposal that was talked about, it's an additional tool in our retirement security toolbox, but it's not a panacea. So only 40 companies nationwide have started utilizing the MyRA program. It's not broadly available to employees. And as you heard earlier, investments are only limited to bonds, which are, you know, a lower interest rate of earnings, and individuals can set aside only $15,000 in their accounts before hitting a savings cap. So MyRA may be a good thing, but it's not the solution. And none of this is the solution. There's always going to be a role for multiple options. You know, there's nothing in this proposal that prohibits a private employer from going out and setting up an employee-based retirement plan on their own. And finally, I just want to mention that, you know, a lot of the work that I do in this building is I run around trying to make sure that we have funds available for services for seniors who don't have financial assets so that they may be on Medicaid. They may need Oregon Project Independence. There's so many of these things that we're looking for funding for. Well, that's part of the goal of this, is to reduce the number of people who need those services provided by the state. In Utah, Brigham Young University just did a study that was released in January that found if you looked at the bottom third of income people in Utah, and they just save 10% more than they do now, the state taxpayers would save $200 million over the next 15 years. That's not even that long a horizon, a time horizon, on saving money for the state. And I don't know exactly how Utah's budget compares to our budget, but that's what they found in Utah, that they could save that kind of money in just 15 years. Just by saving 10% more, and that's just the bottom third income earners. So we have an opportunity to be a leader in Oregon to save for retirement, and we very strongly support this legislation. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Iris Hodge. I'm representing Main Street Alliance. Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. In the interest of brevity, I'm just going to point out like a few pieces from this that we already submitted last week so that we can get out of here. Main Street Alliance is a network of over 2,500 small business owners from across the state. We support House Bill 2960, establishing the Oregon Retirement Savings Fund Board to provide Oregonians with a safe, easy, and effective way to save for retirement. So over the course of our research, the Main Street Alliance found that across the country, more than a third of small business owners are at or near Social Security's full benefit age of 66. Specifically in Oregon, nearly 40% of small business owners are over the age of 55. what we know from a 2012 study by the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Advocacy found that business owners are significantly less likely to hold retirement assets than private sector wage and salary workers, and that owners of smaller businesses with fewer than 25 employees are significantly less likely to invest in retirement assets and have lower amounts of retirement assets than owners of larger firms. The study also found that financially vulnerable small business owners, those who hold a high percentage of their net worth in business assets, are less likely to invest in retirement assets than owners who are less net worth vulnerable. So in the outreach that I've done across the state from Astoria to LaGrande, we've surveyed over 800 business owners, and what we found is that 88% responded that they do not offer a retirement plan to their employees, and over 40% said that they do not have a retirement savings for themselves as business owners. The majority of these also added that their business assets are the bulk of their retirement savings, and that to say they're invested all they have just to keep the doors open and their employees in jobs. The recession has hurt retirement security for small business owners. I'm going to skip that part and just acknowledge that as you consider House Bill 2960, please keep in mind the views of the Main Street businesses all across the state. Main Street business owners are supportive of a plan that is voluntary, portable, flexible, and easy to access. Workers will be allowed to choose to participate or opt out. The plan will stay with workers from job to job with funds deposited into an individual retirement account and not tied to a single employer. They also support pooled and professionally managed plan. A well-managed plan will improve the health of investments, reduce fees, and protect the interests of Oregon families. They support secure and protected investments by establishing a fund to be held in the public trust. The money Oregonians invest will be shielded from being used to fund other services. At the Main Street Alliance of Oregon, we're grateful to be part of the solution, finding a way to have portable, automatic, secure, pooled retirement option in which employees can contribute will allow for Oregonians to plan and save for their retirement more effectively. In fact, we asked if they would support or oppose Oregon creating a pooled retirement option for small business owners and their employees that would reduce administrative and financial liabilities. Nearly 70% of those surveyed responded they would support such a plan. Giving every working Oregonian an easy way to save for retirement can provide security for all Oregonians. This is the very the very best move for Oregon and small businesses and the communities we serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hurd, did you have a quick question?
Statement. Yeah, Mr. Chair.
You may have time for a statement later, if that's all
right.
Are
we going to have another public hearing?
We will have. We'll definitely have. I'm not sure about the public hearing part, but we'll have more discussions where you can make a statement. I'd really like to get the rest of the testimony done first.
I thought they were at the end.
And then at the end, maybe we will.
Sure.
Is there questions of this particular panel? Thank you so much for your testimony. I really appreciate it. I have a note. Is there a Tim Cowan? Would you like to provide some testimony?
Well, I'll do it real quick, sir.
Thank you. Come on up.
Chair, committee members, my name is Tim Cowan, for the record. After a discussion with the treasurer, he asked me to testify, and basically what I asked him was, after you have the retirement program set up, how do you protect it when the person retires? And because sometimes, because of family members, health, or whatever, they may not have an insurance product or coverage that take away their retirement income. So I'll provide you written testimony, but that's the other half of it. Once they retire, how do they keep it, and how do they use it? And I would like to see in a retirement program, when they start out young, they'll be able to buy a product at a cheap rate that will cover those type of things, whether it's disability or whatever. the issue might be so that they can keep it.
Okay. Thank you. Uh-huh. Appreciate that. And I had was it Kristen Johnson? I know you were signed up earlier. I didn't know if you had anything to add from the...
No. Sorry, Kristen Johnson, Oregon State Treasury. In the interest of time, I will just make myself available if anybody has any questions relating to the bill. But I can always make myself available to come up to people's offices, too.
Thank you. And I appreciate that.
She's with the Treasurer's Office.
Yes. And one of the reasons I highlighted, I'm glad you came up because it reminded me, committee, that in Treasurer Wheeler's testimony, there is a document from Georgetown University about the state initiatives to expand the availability and effectiveness of the private sector retirement plans. I think it's worth reading, and also the document that was mentioned by Richard Schwartz is also on OLIS, which is a report from the task force. I think these are really key to look at as well, and along with all the other pieces that we've received. So thank you very much for being here and monitoring us to some degree. So with that, would you like to go ahead and make your statement now?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
If I may. It's really to my colleagues. Because I've been doing a lot of thinking, because I'm not saying I'm for or against this right now. I'm doing a lot of thinking on it. But, you know, my last name, my gender, my height, any of that kind of stuff, it doesn't define who I am. My choices do in life.
Okay.
And I think what we're really talking about here, I keep hearing what I would call straw man arguments or straw person arguments. I've gone to start up my son's investment account, who's, you know, I started that when he was 9 months old, I believe, for college, you know, business, whatever. I ask everybody that came to his little birthday parties to not bring toys, bring $10, bring $20, whatever you want to give, if anything, bring money, because I'm going to put that in an investment account for him. Because as we said earlier, you can never be too young to start one of these programs. Now, this was not retirement, it was an investment, but it's still stock funds, stock units. Anyway, the point is that I've never had a problem with getting Smith Barney or any of these companies to take my money when I walked into the door. I simply had to save and then go in, and they would, I'd fill out the paperwork and they'd take it. So I'm confused and when I hear there's no access for folks. I think what it really comes down to is that people are not investing in their future. And we say, well, they can't afford it. Well, the mandated 3% that this bill calls for, I don't see how, if they choose to participate in the program, that is, I don't see how that creates 3% extra. They're simply being told you have to put in 3%. So the argument that they can't afford it now, this isn't changing that. I would make the argument that the reason we're facing this crisis, which, by the way, I do not see in any way how this fixes it. This does not change the crisis for people that are, say, 55 and older. They're there, and this is not going to change that. What it could do, potentially, is change the outcomes for people that are my age or younger and so on and so forth. But the real problem is how people are spending their money, whether it's now when they're working or even when they're retired. How are they going to spend their money? How are they going to invest it? We talked about small business owners earlier. I am one. I'm high school educated only. I'm a farmer and a rancher and a contractor in an extremely poor community in rural Oregon. But I have climbed my way to success because I started my own business, frankly, when I was 14, and I've been building on that since. But I invest and I invest. I do not put money in retirement currently in the traditional sense. I dump it back into and reinvest it into my company. And so I'm not really buying into the whole poor small business guy. Because, or gal, they're dumping it back into their company to grow the company because that is their retirement. I think we just have to be careful to say that free American or free Oregonians don't have access. They do have access, but we as a society have gotten too comfortable with programs like Social Security, I believe. In our minds, it's telling us that we can make bad decisions, we can make bad choices, and it'll just be okay in the end. And I think that's what's dangerous, colleagues. And I don't want this program to double down on that
issue. I want us to, we talked about education. We desperately need in our great schools and high schools and colleges for our students to be being taught how to properly invest. I plan on, after the session in the 2015-16 school year, going all throughout my district and talking to these grade schoolers and high schoolers about how I got to where I'm at, how I did it with very little income, and now it's built into something good. And so anyway, I'm just saying, I'm not saying I'm for or against it. I'm just saying I want us to be careful to say, I'm hearing a lot of testimony that frankly confuses me. There's no access. They can't afford it. Well, I don't see the no access part, and I don't see how this makes it affordable for them. I think we're admitting that people are not investing in their future, and so we're going to tell them you've got to do at least 3% of your income to actually invest in your future so society doesn't have to pay for you when you're too old. So I think there's a lot going on here. I don't see private business, whether it's the investment companies or the companies that employ a lot of people, as the enemy here, and I want us to be careful not to demonize them. So I think we're all in this together that we want. I personally, and I know everybody here, wants everybody to be successful. Oh, really? I saved it up for that. All right. The chair's yanking me. He's giving me the hook. I'm done. I'm off the box.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, we listened.
Yeah, we listened. I appreciate it, but I will note that...
Shamia, did you listen?
I listened.
Did you?
We listened. Yeah.
All right.
Employees aren't forced into this. They make a choice.
I know.
So anyway. So with that, does anybody else have, you know, a good 10 minutes they want to spend?
Not today. Not today,
Come
Mr.
on
Chair.
Now. I talked the
taking
least.
My 10 minutes.
Well, thank you for sticking with us. And
I'm the only Republican here. Give me some credit. Come on.
We give you some credit. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2960.
And
I'm going to...
Are you
going to
carry
I'm going to adjourn the Committee on Business and Labor.
How to get
Business and Labor.